This morning we're going to be looking at our next section in Philippians, in particular what it means to be God's people and how we conduct ourselves as God's people. And the most amazing part of God's plan is that He takes broken, sinful, hurting people like us and He brings us into a community together and He creates something great. He transforms people in such a way that they shine as lights in a dark area, that we show forth God's goodness, we show forth God's blessings to us as Christians, and it's a good platform, the best platform that God gives us is our light to share the gospel. Is shining in a dark place is the perfect way to reach the lost, because if we don't shine and we turn off our light and we're not people that show ourselves off as, not show ourselves off, but show ourselves as particularly Christian, then we end up putting, like, you remember the story that Jesus told, the parable where, you know, if there's a city on a hill, you can't hide it, or you don't light a lamp in a house to put a bowl over it, because that destroys the point of even lighting the lamp in the first place. And so we need to make sure that we shine as lights. And so when Paul writes to the Philippians, he's speaking to a community of changed people, people who are boldly proclaiming the gospel of Jesus. However, their boldness, like any proclamation of the truth, ends up in hardship for the church, because the church is suffering. The church is going through persecution. The church is going through hostility from the culture around it. They're not strangers to persecution. They're not strangers to being betrayed by people. And so it's this church, in the midst of anguish and turmoil, they find joy and peace. And so how does this church find joy and peace in the midst of some harsh and terrible situations? However, although this might be the case, some members of the church, it seems, have let bitterness, the anguish at persecution, the anguish at hardship, bitterness and complaining and whinging has started to set in among the members of the church. And it's like a poison. And if you don't address this poison and you don't call out this poison, the poison will continue to grow and it can destroy so many different aspects of our lives. And so grumbling, if you remember the Israelites in the desert, they spent all their time there grumbling and God got so mad at it that He just like straight up killed a whole bunch of people. So God takes this very seriously, and so we need to make sure that we also take this seriously. And if we're honest, I mean, we all like a bit of complaining now and then. I mean, we're all Australians, right? Australians are kind of notorious for being whingers. And I know all of us at some point have complained about how cold it is. Especially if you're Grace, she complains all the time about how cold it is. And it's summer sometimes when she complains about it. I don't understand her. I know I've definitely complained about how annoying it is that on Newcastle Road they changed it from 70 to 60. Like, what's the go with that? That's really annoying. I know some people who complain about the fact that Eels are on the bottom of the ladder and then they got smashed by the Newcastle Knights last night. But complaining seems to be a part of our culture. It seems to be right at the depth of who we are as Australians. We've kind of lost that "she'll be right, mate" sort of attitude over time. And now we, you know, now there's hotlines for all sorts of different complaints. Like, you can call in and complain about anything now. Like, my neighbors are too loud, the dog's too annoying. I actually have a dog that lives like literally right next to me and it whines all day. And I'm just being nonstop complaining this entire week about it. And then I came to this passage and I'm like, oh, should I have been doing that? Anyway, we'll go into it. So some complaining is harmless. It's harmless. Like, I don't want to call out all complaining and say that all complaining is bad. But some complaining can become an attitude that we adopt, and it can create bitterness in our hearts. It can create resentment towards other people. And if it's left unchecked, it will destroy everything in our lives. And that's not an overstatement, because I'll show you exactly how that works. So I think today it's going to be great to unpack this profound passage. And we're going to be learning exactly what Paul has to say to the church in Philippi and how that applies to us. So if you've got your Bibles, why don't you grab those? We're going to be reading from Philippians 2, verses 14 to 18. Philippians 2, verses 14 to 18. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you should also be glad and rejoice with me. So last week, Sam was talking about what it means to work out our salvation. And what it means is that we're working out of a position of already being saved. So the word, rather than, you know, if I said to you, oh, just work it out, it's like you have to go do all the work. Rather, it means work out of a place of being saved, right? Or work in your salvation. That's what we're talking about here. So out of a position of being saved, we're working hard for the good, ultimately because God's working in us, right? Do you remember that from last week? That God works in us both to will and to work for his good pleasure. And so it should give us more confidence to work hard as in living as God's people. It should give us ultimate confidence because God ultimately is working in us. And that's the power we use, we wield in order to go out into this world and do good things for the kingdom of God. But the first thing that Paul says after he kind of makes this point is, do all things without grumbling or disputing. So why does he say that? Why does he say that our lives shouldn't be marked by whinging and complaining? What is Paul talking about? Why is this even important? Well, because grumbling and complaining, it's a symptom of a deep spiritual problem. A life marked by grumbling and complaining shows that deep in a person's heart, something isn't right. Something's not right. Something is wrong. And there is, you know, it's a very sort of unattractive quality, isn't it? Complaining, when you've got someone in your life that just complains all the time, that it destroys any redeemable quality in them that makes you want to hang out with them. In fact, it's something that I guarantee you will destroy and blow up any relationship you have. The first step you need to do is complain about every single thing that person does, and I guarantee you will not have a friend by the end of the week. I guarantee it. And so complaining has destroyed many churches as well. Now, like a discontented attitude in the church blows up churches. For instance, the Baptist denomination, I'm only speaking about the Baptists because I've spent some time in there. I know it's in other churches as well, but the Baptists often will get factions forming in the church because, you know, they move the piano from one side of the church to the other, and one group is really unhappy about that. So they form a faction and they want to vote down this piano being moved. Or there is something else going on. And pastors get like burnt out by this kind of stuff. And all these factions form, they're always arguing, they're always at each other's throats. And the church becomes marked by complaining. Instead of being about Jesus, instead of being about working out of a place of their salvation, their entire church turns to disputing, turns to complaining. And I know in the Baptist churches, I've seen it happen all the time. This can really just go in and just mess things up. And before you know it, that church is dead. It's died. It's got a few members left, but that's it. And there's a book out called, I think it's called Church Planting is for Wimps or something like that. It says, if you want a hard job, go into a dead church and try to revitalize it. Go into a dead church and try to breathe life into it, because that church is almost impossible. That's a hard ministry. Any person that's called to ministry in a church like that has been called to a hard ministry. Why? Because complaining and bitterness and grumbling goes down to a really deep level, and it really messes up churches. I know that there's one pastor in Sydney who he's done revitalization work in a church there, and it's been a really hard job, and he's been telling me stories about it, and I'm just like, oh man, like the roadblocks to simple changes that he wants to make, like people just complaining about everything he does, and it's just impossible to pastor under those circumstances. How can you be a pastor and lead people when every decision you make is scrutinized, people complain about it, there's arguments all the time? If this is an attitude in a church, the church will collapse. And so plenty of churches have this problem. And Paul's saying, church in Philippi, don't let this be you. Don't let this be you. And he's saying the same to our church. I mean, think about the Corinthian church that Paul writes to in the book of Corinthians. That church is just blowing itself up. And there's all these factions at war with each other, and there's arguments, and there's grumbling, and there's complaining, and it's such a terrible quality. And we forget that at the essence of it is complaining. We like to blame it on a whole bunch of other things, but the essence of it is a discontented attitude of the heart. And so, as I said, complaining is a very unattractive quality to have. It soaks into your relationship, and it ruins it, it poisons it. It is a poison that goes in very, very deep. And so there's this psychologist known as John Gottman, and he does a lot of research into marriage. And he worked out a study where he can predict with 94% accuracy whether a couple will make it in the end. And so what he would do is he'd get all these couples into this kind of bed and breakfast, and he'd sort of see, and he could tell, based on that, whether they would break up in the future or not. And some people would be shocked by the accuracy of it, and he'd be like, "Why? They seemed fine. Why do you think these guys are going to break up?" But what was the key thing is that the relationship between the husband and wife, they were like walking on eggshells. They were really afraid of offending one another. They were really afraid of setting people off. So while they were speaking calmly with one another, while they might be having a conversation, they're actually really, their heart rate is up. There's a lot of stuff going on physiologically because it's like they're sitting next to a predator, which is weird. So they're showing the same signs as if there was a predator near you. And so for the husband and the wife, they're both predator and prey to each other. And so they see each other as predators, ready to call out the little things that they do. Every little tiny thing that they do, they're going to get in trouble. And so he tells an analogy of how, you know, a wife might come in and she might look out the window and there's like a beautiful cardinal. And she says, "Oh, husband, honey, there's a beautiful cardinal outside." And he has three choices usually of what the husband can do. So the husband can do the first thing, which is go, "Oh, I don't want to look at your stupid bird." And then he sits down and he can make one decision like that. The second decision is he can go, "Oh," and then he gets up and he goes and has a look at the bird. And he's like, "Oh, wow, what a cool bird." And it's kind of like fake, it's sarcastic. The third one is he gets up and he happily looks at the bird. And he says, "Oh, wow, that's a nice looking bird." Three different things. If he does the first two, it's highly likely that marriage is going to fail. It's already failing. Why is that? Because there's a complaining attitude. There's a hostility between the couple now. Rather than him getting up and sacrificing and going towards her and looking at the bird. And it's interesting that, like, it's just interesting that was such a small thing can blow up a marriage. It can blow up a relationship. And it will blow up any relationship you have. A relationship with a parent. I know if you have, like, a hypercritical parent, that parent can just destroy your relationship with their child. And it ends up blowing up a whole bunch of things. And so I think we all know this deep down. I don't think I'm blowing your mind by this. I think you all know that deep down complaining is really kind of dodgy. It leads to us just kind of destroying everything. And so when Paul says don't grumble, don't dispute, he's not saying it because he wants to, you know, stop us from having any opinions or stop us from, you know, sharing some improvements we might have. He's stopping us from having a discontented attitude, which ends up putting ourselves against, ultimately, God. And as I said, complaining is only the symptom, because there's something deeper at play when we're talking about complaining. And what's deeper? It's a failure to trust God. That's the key issue. It's a failure to trust God and His providential will. It will have a drastic effect on your faith and your relationship with God. Trust me. A holy, godly saint, if you think of like the most godly person you know, do you think they spend all their time complaining about God? Like, I don't think that's a quality that kind of person has. And if that's our quality that we have all the time with God, that we're always complaining, always finding fault in the things that God does, always arguing with His word, always never willing to submit to who He is, well, ultimately it can destroy even our relationship with God. And so at the heart of it is an attitude. The first attitude is towards God, and then we let it set in everywhere. We let it set into our church, we let it set into our marriages, we let it set into our relationships. And so God takes this very seriously. As I said, He has killed many people for grumbling in the Old Testament. It's pretty brutal if you read it. He takes it seriously because it is a big problem. It's not a small problem. It is a big problem. And ultimately, all these complaints we do, even if we're not directing them at the Lord, we end up laying them at the feet of the Lord, because ultimately, if you push it back to its logical conclusion, we're complaining about the way that God has done things. We're complaining about the things that God has put into our lives. And we're saying that we have a bad lot, that God ought to treat us better. And so I think this leads us really nicely into Paul's next point. And so that part of our unity and the work of the Holy Spirit within us, if we set aside grumbling and complaining, we end up shining like lights in our culture. So let's read verse 15. He says, "Do nothing without grumbling or complaining, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. So I think there's two things that Paul wants us to understand in this verse, that in order to reach the world as lights and shine brightly in the darkness, we need to pay close attention to our character, to who we are, and secondly, to our message. So what, who we are ultimately and what we say. Those are the two things that I think Paul wants us to pay close attention to. I don't think I need to convince any of you that character is really important, that who you are is really important to your Christian witness. Because anyone can sniff out a hypocrite. If there's anything Australians are really good at, it's sniffing out a hypocrite. We know when someone doesn't mean it. That's why half the time we spend our time like bagging out politicians, because we know they're lying to us. And we don't want to be the kind of Christians where we'll make claims about God and they think, oh, he doesn't believe that. He doesn't act it out. She doesn't believe this. That's not part of her life. We don't want to be those kind of Christians where they just think it goes in one ear and it goes out the other ear, because they just think, nah, this person has no credibility. They have no integrity. If we claim to be children of God, you would think at the kind of bottom level we would reflect at least some aspect of God's character. And if we fail to reflect anything of God, then it probably means that we're deluding ourselves by the fact that we are children of God. If our lives haven't been transformed, then why are we claiming that the gospel transforms people? And so I think we've got to reflect to some extent the qualities of our Father in heaven, if in fact we are indeed children of the Lord. So Paul urges the Philippians to maintain their integrity in their walk as Christians. And it's really important. I want you guys to remember that. Maintain your integrity. You shining as a light in this culture is really tied to your integrity as a Christian, as who you are and what you stand up for and what you do. Your actions more than often speak louder than your words. But words are important, and we're going to get to that. So the next thing he says is a crooked and twisted generation. A crooked and twisted generation. What's going on there? What does he mean there? Now, we would say something is crooked these days to mean like someone's a crook. If we mean they're a crook, we mean they're pretty dodgy, pretty immoral. I think what Paul's meaning here is he does have that sort of in mind, but what he means is crooked in the literal sense. Like the word that we have here in the Greek is where we get scolios, which is where we get scoliosis from. If you know that disease of the spine, your spine goes curvy. It means that you're not straight. If you're crooked, you're not straight. You're not on the straight and narrow. You're not on the right path. And it means that, and twisted as well, if you get that kind of image, you've got a generation who are wandering aimlessly about. They're not on the straight and narrow. They're in the darkness. They don't quite know what is going on. He's speaking of a culture, ultimately, that's turned aside from God, that has rejected God, that isn't walking down the straight path that God has laid out. And the pagan generation of Paul's day is hopelessly lost in all these different gods and all these different rituals and all these different sacrifices. And it's the same in our culture. Our culture is hopelessly lost. They're crooked. They're not on the right path. And what we do is we shine as lights directing that clear path, that straight path, the path to the Lord. And so that's why we shine brightly in darkness. But if we're not living the right way, we're not showing the right path, how can we even begin to shine? I don't know how we can think that we could possibly shine in those situations. And so this has never changed. It's the same in our culture. It was the same in Paul's culture. Integrity matters. Integrity matters. And so that's when we think about complaining, I think complaining is laying up a whole bunch of things at the feet of God. And it shows a real lack of integrity, and it's really unattractive. And you think that complaining about your lot, complaining about the things God has given you, complaining about all this stuff is going to attract people to the Lord. It's going to make people want to come to faith or come to church. Like, I would assume that if I met this really complaining Christian, that everyone in our church was really complaining like this person. And we don't want that to be part of who we are. We don't want that to be part of our DNA. So I think, just before I move on, I think appetite and your hunger and your thirsting for God is one of the key things that is going to shine forth as a light. It's really that desire to want to glorify Jesus. It's that desire to want to make Jesus, like make much of Jesus. And do you remember that analogy I used where, you know, if you imagine the sun, you like throw a lasso around the sun, you pull it close. The closer you pull the sun to you, the more intense you're going to feel that heat. That's sort of what we do when we glorify the Lord. As we show our appetite and our hunger and our thirst for Jesus, as we show how much he means to us and how much he's changed our lives, we're bringing him close and we're making people sweat from the heat as we bring Jesus close to them, as they feel his glory. And I really like that analogy. I randomly thought about it in my last sermon, and I was like, I'm just going to keep running with that one. But yeah, so I think shining his light is so important. And so think about the person who's had the most influence in your life. If you can think about the person who's had the most influence in your life, or think about one person who's really influenced you. Think about that person's character. Was it merely the things they said to you that had the biggest influence, or was it who they were that had the big influence over you? Because, you know, there's this guy named Jordan Peterson. He's like this psychologist, and he's really good at speaking to young men. And the first thing he tells them is to, like, clean your room, make your bed. And then all these young guys are like, this is really profound. I should go do that. But they don't realize their mom has been telling them to do that their whole lives, right? But it's because of who he is, and they know that this guy is really for them, and he wants to, like, improve their life. I'm not saying their mothers aren't like that, but you kind of get an understanding of what I'm talking about, right? This guy can say something as mundane as, like, make your bed. And then all these guys are like, wow, I should go do that. That's so wonderful. That's amazing. It's just like, oh my gosh. So, character matters. Character really does matter because it carries with it influence. And so in addition to our character is content. Our content. And it's what we say and how we say it, and from a place of having character, speaking into situations. And so look at verse 16. So in the process of shining his lights, the passage says, holding fast to the word of life. Now I have an interesting note about the translation of the Greek here. Holding fast can also mean holding forth. And it's interesting because that's almost like complete opposite things. Holding like something fast, like really close and tightly, as opposed to holding something forth so someone can take it. Yeah, well, it can mean both things. Just like in English, words can have different meanings depending on the context. It's the same here in the Greek. The ESV is gone for holding fast. But, you know, for instance, in Homer's Odyssey, this word is used to talk about holding forth a gift for people. And I think in the context of shining as lights in our culture, I think it makes more sense that it's holding forth. And, I don't lightly argue with the translators of the ESV. But I think holding forth the word of life really makes sense here. Now, of course, that also means holding fast to it. We don't just give it away and be like, okay, we've handed the gospel message on. We don't need it anymore. That would be ludicrous, obviously. But I think, you know, when we shine as lights in our terms of our character, and then we share the message of the gospel. Because what does it say? It says the word of life. Well, what is the word of life? It's the word that brings life. And if you know anything about Paul and read any of Paul's messages, what word brings life? The gospel. It's got to be the gospel. I don't know what else Paul could possibly be talking about. It's the message of freely giving grace and salvation that God gives to people. He gives life to people. Life is the ultimate quality. I know in our youth group we've been going through the I Am statements of John, and literally every single statement talks about life. And it's like life in abundance, life to the full. It's not just that we live forever, but it's also the quality of life we have now. I heard an awesome quote where it's like, moralism can't save you, and immorality can't satisfy you, but Jesus does both. And it's true. Jesus has saved us, and he does satisfy us. He satisfies our deepest desires. Ephesians 2:1 says that every human being is dead in their trespasses and in their sins, but if you believe in Jesus, you're made alive. And it's both quantity and quality of life that we get. And so this is the word of life, the message of the gospel. We hold this forth. We hold it out to people. So from a place of shining, we can now offer. And I don't know if you've seen people come to faith often, but usually they come. It's not like you walk up to them, you share the gospel, and then boom, they just come to faith. Sometimes that happens, but usually it's like toiling with people and really starting to get to know people and having relationships with people and building that rapport with them. From that platform, you can now share the gospel. And I think this is very much what Paul is going on about here. Shine like lights in your culture, then hold forth the word of life. Hold it forth to people. And so that's why, you know, grumbling, complaining, arguing can't compare to worshiping God faithfully, joyfully, working out our salvation, you know, with fear and trembling is the opposite to complaining and grumbling. And in the process of shining as lights in the world, hold out that gospel. Hold out that gospel. It saves you, it will save them, it will give people transformation that, you know, like a transformed life is the greatest advertisement for the gospel, isn't it? I mean, if you're claiming that the gospel transforms lives and then your life isn't really transformed, you're not really advertising the thing that you're proclaiming, are you? I think advertising, like a transformed life, is the greatest advertising. It's not a negative, not a griping, not a complaining spirit, but a joyful, peaceful, thankful, positive, enthusiastic trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, if you were at gospel communities, we like went through 6 different passages of the Bible and talked about them. And every single one of them, it talked about obedience and obeying joyfully. We come from a position of wanting to obey. And if we don't come from a position of wanting to obey, we need to delve even more down into the gospel, because that's where we're going to find the resources in order to be faithful witnesses of Jesus. And so Paul is talking first about living as a light, so we can be a light to the lost and that they can see the gospel that we're holding forth to them. So thirdly, we have another interesting one. He says right at the end of that little passage we read, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run or labor in vain. Very interesting sort of thing that Paul's saying here. He's basically saying, do it for my sake. Do it for my sake so that I would not have run the race in vain. That's interesting. What's going on there? Well, if you remember Paul, you know, you can read about it in the book of Acts when Paul planted this church. And Paul pours his energy, all his effort, he pours all of himself into this church, and he has this pastor's heart. And he loves these people greatly, and they loved him. Because when he went to leave this church, I think it is this church or the Ephesians, there are churches in this area that when he went to leave, they would be weeping with him because they loved him so much and they knew they were never going to see him again. In those times, when you went on a big, like, it's not like we can get on a plane and go, you know, travel and visit each other. When he left, that was pretty much the only time they'd probably ever see him again. And they knew it was, like, it was really sad. And it's kind of like a heartbreaking passage in Acts if you ever read it. But Paul really loves them, and so he wants to plead with them. He's kind of, we're still on this grumbling, complaining thing. He's like, you know, do it for your witness. Do it for your character. Do it for the word of life, and do it for me. Don't let complaining come into this church and pull it apart. Do it out of love for me. Because he loves this church greatly, and he doesn't want to see this church, he doesn't want all the work, the running, and the laboring that he did for this church come to nothing. Because this church blows itself up because of complaining and grumbling. He doesn't want it to come to nothing. And he's saying, do it for me. Do it because you love me. And he knows I love him. And he's like, because if you take any church and you take the pastor out of a church, you leave a huge vacuum of power that a lot of people try to fill almost immediately. And they do it out of good motives, a lot of them, because they see the lacking. So if we just plucked Sam out of our church and put him somewhere else, there is a vacuum of power. Now, I'd like to hope that we wouldn't all form into factions of, you know, this is our opportunity to get what we want in this church because Sam's gone. No, that's not, it's not like Gaz won't form a faction of reading books every week or something like that because Sam's gone.
That's not going to happen.
But yeah, so out of this vacuum, Paul's left, and it seems that there's people wanting to fill his shoes, which rightfully so, that should happen, but it can lead to a place of complaining. Which is why when we talk about, in our last week, he said, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Why does he say in my absence? Because sometimes it's really easy when we're held accountable and we have a, you know, a giant in the faith, a really respected and godly person that's, you know, kicking our butts all the time and making sure we're doing stuff. But you remove them out of the equation, sometimes we're like, oh, sweet, and then we just start living our own way, start doing stuff. And Paul's saying, you know, don't let it come to that. Don't let it come to that. Obey even more now that I'm gone. You don't need me. All you need is Jesus. And so don't blow this church apart. And so I think it's sort of like an interesting statement from Paul, but he encourages them to obey even more in his absence, to press hard into their community, press hard into their ways, so that they wouldn't be marked by grumbling and complaining. And so what does this reveal? It's not so much Paul's heart, but it also reveals God's heart towards us, right? God's heart towards us is the same as Paul's. That's why this is in God's word. God didn't put this in his word because he didn't think it was, you know, not important. Obviously, this is really important. It reflects God's heart for us as well. And we should make sure that we don't let grumbling and disputing shatter our church. We can't go down that path. And so now we have an interesting verse to end with. And it's actually kind of hard to understand. I remember I got stumped by it when I read it for the first time, where he says, verse 17, "Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you should also be glad and rejoice with me." And I was kind of like, what's going on here? He's like a drink offering getting poured out, and then they have some sacrificial offering of their faith, and he's getting poured onto that. I don't know what's going on here. So I had to do a little bit of research, and luckily I do know what it's about now. But in the ancient world, and it was true for like pagans and Jews as well, they would have this thing called a drink offering. And so what they would do is they'd get a big sacrifice, they'd put the sacrifice on the altar, and they would burn the sacrifice. And then what you would do is some people would pour out wine. It was usually wine. Sometimes they'd pour out water, and we have even one account of pouring out honey. But generally there was these drink offerings, and they'd either be poured in front of the sacrifice or on the top of the sacrifice. It was usually on the top of the sacrifice because when you poured it, steam would come up and the steam would rise up, and it sort of signified the offering rising up into the nostrils of the deity and the deity being pleased and, you know, smelling the pleasing aroma of the sacrifice being offered. That's sort of what's going on. So the drink offering was like a capping off. It was like the final thing you did with the sacrifice. It was the last kind of hurrah for the sacrifice. And so what's Paul talking about here? He's seeing himself as this drink offering getting poured out onto this sacrifice, and the sacrifice is the faith of the Philippians. Okay, that still doesn't really help us work out exactly what's going on here. But he's basically, because in it it says, even if I am to be poured. And this is another kind of, I'm going to deviate a little bit from the text again here. As I said, I don't often argue with the ESV, but I think it's in the present tense. It's being, since I am being poured out. It's like, I am currently being poured out as a drink offering. So some people think it means Paul's talking about when he's going to die, when the Romans are finally going to kill him. Because he's in jail, remember? He's chained up to a Roman soldier day in and day out. And so some people think, oh, he's saying that, you know, I'm on my way out. I'm just dying right in a minute. No, I think what he's going through, the sacrifices he's going through now, the fact that he's in prison. Why is he even in prison? He's in prison because he's preaching the gospel. He's preaching the very message that has saved the Philippians. That's why he's in prison in the first place. And so he's saying, you know, I'm here because of your faith. I'm here because of a whole bunch of people's faith. And I'm joyful. I'm glad that I'm here. I'm damn glad that I'm here. Because I'd much rather be here in prison by preaching the gospel than somewhere else without preaching the gospel, without living for God, without doing any of this stuff. I don't complain. The fact that I'm here for Jesus isn't a cause to complain. In fact, it's so much better for him that he's there for that reason. For him, that's all the more reason to rejoice. So this is sort of the completion of almost their... Well, no, I won't say that. Not their faith. It's sort of like a tricky thing. I'm trying to find the right words for it. Think of... So Paul's this drink offering being poured on the faith. It's sort of like, I'm here because of you. But what's the greater sacrifice among these two? It's not his drink offering. It's the sacrifice of the faith. That was the big kind of important sacrifice that you'd offer to the gods, was the pig or the cow or the calf or the goat or the lamb. Whatever you would offer on that sacrifice, that was the important one. The drink offering was a capping off. So some people think, you know, Paul's being a little bit, you know, egotistical. He's kind of talking about himself all the time. But he's kind of being really humble. And he's saying, look, guys, your sacrifice for the faith is way more important than my sacrifice. If you want to compare my sacrifice, I'm just a drink offering on the top of this sacrifice. You guys are going through some tough stuff. There's some tough persecution going on in your church. But I'm just a drink offering. I'm just this little tiny offering right at the end. So they're feeling sorry for Paul. And Paul's like, I don't feel sorry for myself. I'm just a drink offering. You guys are making real sacrifices. Which is important. Why? Because this church are letting grumbling and disputing come in because they're facing persecution, I think. I think that's what is going on in the text. That persecution has come and they're starting to feel a bit sorry for themselves. They're just starting to complain a little bit. And so this is why Paul is saying, you know, I'm not complaining. In fact, I rejoice in my situation. And even though I'm this little drink offering, I want you guys to rejoice with me in the fact that I'm making the sacrifice for Jesus. And I rejoice with you all because of the sacrifice you're making for Jesus. And that's why we should all rejoice together. Our attitude should be one of rejoicing. It shouldn't be one of complaining. It shouldn't be one of disputing. So although I'm going through hardship, I'm not going through anything compared to you guys. So don't feel sorry for me. Don't feel sorry for yourselves. Because in Jesus we can have rejoicing. In Jesus we can have peace. And so if Paul, the fearless leader who had planted this church, is rejoicing in his situation, then they have all the more reason to rejoice with him, right? Because he's a huge influence over them. Which is also interesting because now his character is having a big influence on them. This kind of comes full circle in what we're talking about. So they need to rejoice in their suffering for the cause of Christ. And so the temptation is there to always complain for us. The temptation is always there to find fault. But if you remember, to live is Christ and to die is gain. To live is Christ and to die is gain. There's nothing in this world that this world can take away from us. And what can you do to people who have that motto? To live is Christ, to die is gain. So find your joy in the Lord Jesus. Real joy, lasting joy. That can only come through a deep relationship with the Lord. And only then can grumbling be turned to joy. Only then can disputing be laid to rest. And so I ask you this morning, how do you cope with hardship when persecution or struggle or trials or tribulations come along? What is your attitude? How do you cope with those things when things don't go the way you want them to go? Do you manage to maintain your joy in the gospel through all of that? Or does grumbling and a discontented attitude start to well up inside of you and you start to find fault with things around you? And so I think it's really important to remember this passage here because grumbling really can destroy your life, it can destroy your church, and it's a really powerful attitude to have in your hearts.